We love music. We love podcasts. We love audiobooks. And the best way to listen is with a pair of Bluetooth wireless headphones. And we have some cool ones we want to tell you about. They're made by Raycon, R-A-Y-C-O-N.
And they're about half the price of other premium wireless earbuds on the market, but they sound just as good. And their latest model, the E25, is their best one yet. It has 6 hours of playtime, seamless Bluetooth pairing, more bass, and a more compact design. I think you'll love it.
Tell us about that seamless Bluetooth pairing. You just pulled yours out of the box, and what happened to you, Freeman?
Scott, I did an unboxing. I pulled it out, and all of a sudden, all I had to do is go to my Bluetooth, and it was already ready to pair. There was zero effort. Easy to do.
You didn't have to push a button and wait for it to show up. It just automatically did it, didn't it?
That's right.
I loved them. I was playing with them recently and noticed I was really surprised with the quality, especially the bass.
Now it's time to get the latest and greatest from Raycon. Get a 15% off your order at buyraycon.com. That's buyraycon.com/TRN.
That's buyraycon.com/TRN. Get 15% off those E25s. Exoskin, they're our favorite toe sock. You got to get a pair. We have a new product, though, that they just came out with. They just launched on their website. It is the new skull cap.
And if it's good for the toes, it's good for the head, Scott.
They got you covered from head to toe, don't they,
and,
Freeman?
And they're using that technology to help us perform better, to keep us cool, to keep us warm, to keep us efficient. And we just looked at this great-looking skull cap and read some information on it. And some of the technology that they have in this material makes the difference.
One of them is it has the copper fibers that you are well aware of if you've tried their socks. Copper fibers keep bacteria from growing, keeps the stink away. And that's what you want in good clothing.
Hey, this just isn't your grandmother's knitted cap. This is something completely different that can help you perform the way you want.
Has airflow sphere technology. That they have a trademark on that.
As they should. So go to their website, check it out, and take a look around because they have a lot more than just toe socks and skull caps.
Try it out. It is the 7.0 Skull Flex Cap. It's a great deal. Go to exoskin.com. Go to our partners page and click on the banner, and you will see the discount code there.
All right. We ready?
Yeah. But I know it's on the upper edge, and you guys have won a couple of awards. And
Let's start over.
Yeah.
You're recording this, aren't you, Freeman?
I get everything. All right. We ready?
Yeah.
All right. Welcome to another edition of Trail Runner Nation. My name is Don Freeman.
And I'm Scott War. And we're back with one of our most popular guests, Dr. Phil Maffetone. He's been on the podcast, probably a dozen times.
And should have been on another dozen because always fun, always good. And welcome back, Dr. Phil Maffetone.
Thanks, Scott. And Don, it's such a pleasure to be here. And it's always a lot of fun. And I always look for when I get your emails and you twist my arm and say, we have to have you on. It's a daily countdown. I look at the calendar and said, oh, I got to wait that long to be on with these guys. So thank you.
Hey, if you don't know who Dr. Phil Maffetone is, go back and Google search Trail Runner Nation and Dr. Phil Maffetone. You can also find him at philmaffetone.com. He's an author of, at least my last count, probably a dozen books, including the resource material called The Big Red Book and The Big Yellow Book. The Red Book is the big book of health and fitness. The Yellow Book is the big book of endurance training and racing. If you don't have those books, you need to make sure you have them on your shelf. These aren't books that you can get the audio version, but it's good to have them in paperback or in paper so that you can use them as a resource.
You want to dog ear a few corners. You want to rip out a page and stuff it in your pack so that you can resource it as you're climbing a hill because there's just valuable information out there.
You can actually take pages out and put it in your shoes and use them as insoles. It's that valuable.
Hey, Scott.
It's a very valuable thing to do. And some people rip the pages out and throw them away.
including you, because you're not afraid to take a look at a topic and then revise it as new information comes in. And that's always a good sign about a researcher, being vulnerable to your own position. And that's what you've done.
Hey, well, thanks. And I do that all the time. And I also use those two books in particular because they're sort of a composite of so much of what I did up until that point. I do use them as references, not because I forget what I talked about, but because I want to see how I explained it. And with questions, especially from people, I think, well, gee, didn't I explain that well enough? Or somebody will ask a question that makes me think, gee, I need to address that aspect of this this topic even further. But yeah, you know, you're right. With research in mind in particular, we should always be going back and rethinking what it is we're doing, and with the idea of trying to improve it. We want to always get better. I just had a new scientific paper that's going to be published shortly, where I was reading some new research on the overfat pandemic that I hadn't done, and I said, wow, look at this new research, and I realized that I was wrong in my estimates of the global numbers of overfat people, where I said, hey, up to 76% of the world is overfat. I realized that that number is way too low. And so I wrote a paper on revisiting the global overfat pandemic, which will be out shortly. But, you know, we have to continually update our everything, our life.
Hey, let's talk a little bit about that article, because Scott has that on his list of things to talk about.
Yeah, so one thing we didn't do a podcast. Usually when you come out with a new book, we do a podcast. We didn't do a podcast when you published a book back in 2017 called The Overfat Pandemic, exposing the problems and its simple solutions for everyone who needs to eliminate excess body fat. And you recently wrote an article that kind of parlays or complements that, talking about weight loss and how it's misunderstood. Tell us, what is the biggest, so this is a big industry. I mean, there are diet books, there are cookbooks, there are pills, it seems like it's a multi, maybe possibly billion-dollar industry.
It's a multi-billion dollar industry for sure.
What don't we understand about weight loss?
I think people need to realize that as this multi-billion dollar, it's really a multi-trillion dollar industry when we look at how many years it's been around. As we have seen that industry get bigger and bigger, so have people, so has the population. and you'd think if these diets actually worked, people would be getting smaller. And that obviously has not happened. We have developed this overfat pandemic, which is a very serious problem, and it's not well understood. It's not talked about in the media yet. They'll talk about, you know, the obesity epidemic, which is a relatively small epidemic that's out there. The difference is that overfat is a condition that includes people who are overweight, people who are obese, and a high number of people who are normal weight and not obese, who have excess body fat. And the overfat state, as I defined it in the paper in 2017, the term overfat refers to excess body fat that impairs health and fitness. If you want to be a better runner and you have excess body fat, it's going to impair your running. If you're concerned about your health, excess body fat will trash your health. And it doesn't take a whole lot. You don't have to be obese. You don't even have to be overweight. And what the new studies are showing, and why I have revisited this item, And why I realized that the initial projections, the initial estimations worldwide, only if, you know, in 2017, that's not that long ago. The reason I realized that those numbers were too low is because the new studies show that other populations, other ethnicities are showing tremendous amounts of overfat in normal weight people. And I showed that initially in 2018, I think, where I showed that with an Indian colleague I worked with, I showed that 80% of Indian adults were overfat. And in fact, 40% of them had normal body weight. So it's very misleading. And if you think because you're a runner, if you think because you might be eating well, that you can't be overfat, you may be fooling yourself, because and it's such an easy thing to figure out, and we can talk about that in a moment. But we need to understand that excess body fat is not something that just pertains to us not looking as cute in the mirror, but it's a real serious problem. The big thing, in addition, is that it's the first stage of chronic disease. We're talking about heart disease, Alzheimer's, cancer, diabetes, and all the diseases that not only are killing people in the Western world, but now are the number one killer in the developing world, replacing infectious diseases. This is the first stage of all these other epidemics they talk about, you know, which is becoming, I won't say it's comical, because it's a very serious condition, but you see, you know, I recently saw something about China and the diabetes epidemic, India and the you know, the epidemics that are starting there with heart disease. You know, these are little tiny fragments of a big picture, and I don't know why people don't want to look at the big picture. And when I say people, I'm talking about governments, healthcare agency. The World Health Organization doesn't even recognize overfat, or at least they've never used the word. But it's becoming, and it's nothing new. I've been using it my whole career. It's nothing new, because the research out there about excess body fat and how it's harmful is overwhelming. There's so much good information out there.
Hey, Phil, can you be overweight but not over fat? If we're looking at the body mass index that the government came out with, can you be overweight but not over fat?
You can be, and this is the problem with BMI, body mass index, where they, you know, they weigh you, and then they, you know, there's a formula to figure out BMI, and it's the problem with BMI is that they've been using it for decades and decades, and they have all this data. So if you're a researcher and you want to do a study on whatever that involves weight and body, you know, body mass, you're going to use BMI. At least one of the things you're going to use is BMI, because there's so much other data that you can compare and say, well, we found this, and past research showed the same thing, so therefore we must be right. Well, that's not necessarily true. It's very misleading. If you're overweight, that means you're overweight by some standard, by some scale that the insurance industry or some research has compiled, and they said, you know, if you're 6 feet, you shouldn't weigh more than this. Well, if you're an athlete, if you're a lineman as a football player, there's a good chance you have a lot of muscle. You've built up a lot of muscle. we won't talk about how you did that, but you did, and you've got this huge mass of muscle that weighs a lot. And of course, most of that weight is water, the muscle, so you have more water in it. And that can be confusing because the numbers don't add up. But for the most part, none of that really makes much difference. If you want to know about body fat, people think of body fat percentage. You know, what is my percent body fat? And in order to do that, you really need a DEXA scan or some device that costs a lot of money. And in all practicality, you have to follow up on a regular basis with that test. And you don't want to do that just to come up with a percentage of body fat. Instead, what has correlated with that percentage body fat quite well is the waist to height ratio. The waist to height ratio does away with the problems that the original waist measurements, the waist to hip ratios, the other measures that they did for years, where they eventually would find that, well, certain ethnicities don't fit into that model. Well, the waist to height ratio now is the best measure that an individual could do, and it works for children, it works for people who are in their 80s, and everyone in between, and obviously not for pregnant women, but it's a very, very accurate measure, and you can answer the question, am I over fat, by just measuring yourself. And the simple bottom line answer is that your waist should be less than half your height.
Repeat that one more time. My waist should be half of my height?
Should be less than half your height. So if you're 6 feet tall and your waist is 35 inches, then you'd be considered normal fat as opposed to over fat. And it's pretty simple. And I suggest you measure your height because everybody wants to be taller. And as we grow up, you know, we keep being taller even though we're not. So measure it in the morning because you're going to be a little taller because your spine is a little longer in the morning. So, and you can get a piece of string. If you're 6 feet, cut a piece of string at 6 feet and just double it over and wrap it around your waist at the level of your belly button. And that string should overlap.
The string of truth. That's what we call it. Hey, so here's... Dr. Phil, here's what I want to know.
The trail running string.
Here's what I want to know. And you can get those on Amazon, by the way, the string of truth.
TRN is selling those on our website.
Yeah.
Scissors not included.
Hey, so here's my question to you. As a runner, and I did the math, by the way. My math says I'm okay without that string of truth. I did a few calculations there. Probably all of us did. But here's what I want to know. Where does this body fat hide? If we are the right weight as we're looking at the scale, and we even look at the mirror and go, yeah, I don't see any fat here hanging over my belt. If we're over fat, where is that fat hiding?
Well, it could hide any place, but it typically hides in the belly, and it may not be visible if you've had to get a larger pant size in recent years. And I used to say if your pants are now bigger than when you graduated high school, but a lot of overfat kids are graduating high school, so we can't say that anymore. But if you've had to expand your waist with clothing that's bigger, then that's a giveaway. And if you see or if you measure that your your fat in the abdominal area is, if you see that you're over fat and you look in the mirror, you look lean, then there's a good chance it's in your belly and it's kind of hidden away in there. But what that also means is that you are storing excess fat around the heart as well. And that gets really dangerous. I mean, the belly fat is unhealthy enough. Belly fat is associated with chronic inflammation, and chronic inflammation in the belly affects organs and glands throughout the body. It affects joints, it affects muscles, it affects everything potentially. And that's a serious problem. But when you have excess body fat starting to settle around the heart, the first thing that's affected is your heart. And of course, that pattern of excess body fat causing chronic inflammation, causing disease, has started, you know, some time ago.
You mentioned earlier India, China. Is this overfat problem, is it a pandemic problem, or is it primarily within our borders within the United States, as you reference these changes?
Well, that's what I thought originally. I did the global assessment, and that first paper I did with Paul Larson and Ivan Rivera also worked with us. But I looked at the numbers, and the research I had available was going back to the 80s, actually. And a lot of the research was done on Caucasians. And as they started looking at other ethnicities, we saw that Asians were much higher. The numbers of normal weight Asians who were over fat was much higher, especially in South Asia, so India, Pakistan, that whole area. And when you start looking at just India and China, I mean, that's, you know, now you're approaching half the world's population, but also Africa, Latin America, you know, basically all the non-white populations have higher numbers of overfat people due to relative numbers, due to the fact that the normal weight individuals have much higher overfat rates. And that's a genetic factor. The question comes up always, you know, how can so many Indians, for example, be overfat? 80% of Indian adults are overfat. I thought they were the ones who were starving to death. Well, yeah, starvation still is a problem, and that's being improved year after year, but starvation is still a problem even in the U.S. But we have the, you know, that image of a thin Indian male, typically, who has a big belly, has a pot belly, and that comes from carbohydrates. And how far back do we have to go to look at how that problem started? We have to go back to the 50s and 60s when Western countries started to give these developing nations who were starving to death, and certainly it kept people from starving to death, but what they gave them, what they sent them over there, you know, week after week, was junk food. And they got them addicted to junk food, and now junk food is as big a part in Indian life as it is in the U.S., you know, all the Western lifestyles.
It really speaks to starvation for calories versus starvation for nutrients, that we can not be hungry, but our body still needs certain nutrients that we're just not feeding it by giving, giving these foods that, like you said, are junk food or just high caloric to satisfy the fact that these people need some food, but it's not really very powerful food.
Yes, and it's a good point. And what's interesting is that in that time period, we've literally been able to change their genes, and they're now showing that Indians, for example, who were born in the United States, are equally as overfat as Indians in India. Mm-hmm. So all of the native populations all over the world, there's natives in all countries, in all regions, and they have the same problem. Aborigines in Australia, the American Indians in the U.S. and so forth, and this has been a serious problem from a health, physical health and mental health standpoint for decades, and we now know why it is. We knew a few years ago, but we now know for sure why that is.
Dr. Phil, let's get into some brass tacks here. So the audience that's listening to this podcast, maybe they've taken out their string and they've measured their belly. And, you know, statistically, there's a lot of people that are listening to this podcast that probably didn't pass the test, that string had to be stretched a little bit.
A guarantee. Yeah,
and the TRN string has some elastic properties to it. So yes. That's why you want this one.
You're welcome. my question is the typical, what we typical have learned through whatever media or whatever is, okay, I'm a little bit over fat or overweight, however you want to define it, and I need to do something about that. And so they go on this checkbook method that I need to eat less and exercise more, and I need to track calories. What's wrong with that, and how should we change that paradigm?
All of those things are wrong. They're dead wrong. And we've known they've been wrong for years. We now have data to show that. For example, I was looking at the latest CDC data 2 years ago, I think it was. And I said, holy cow. Are you allowed to curse on this show?
Yeah, you are.
Cow is a three-letter word. You can use that.
Okay. Yeah, that isn't a cuss word, Dr. Phil. It's not one of the seven you can't say.
And what? Seven. Hang on a second.
he's writing them down right now. What are the seven? Was that George Carlin?
Yeah.
Gosh, I missed that.
Oh,
when you don't have a TV, there's certain things that you really miss.
You need to Google that.
We'll send that link to you, Dr. Phil, so you don't have to do the research. You. We don't need you to go down any other rabbit holes. We'll get you down to the right hole.
Okay. Speaking of links, we can come back to this because I don't want to go off topic because this is really important. But there's another important link to a TV show that we should mention. So I looked at this and went through my holy cow thing, and I said, wow, Americans are exercising more than ever, and at the same time, overweight, obesity, and overfat have increased. And it's pretty well, I mean, I've known this for years, but to gather data and say, hey, this is what's happening. I could do that in an article a general article, and say, well, this is my opinion, or this is what I found when I was in practice. But to publish it in a scientific journal, it's a different world that you have to go into. And so I was able to do that, and with Paul Larson, my friend and co-writer, who you should have on your podcast sometime if you haven't already. We wrote a paper called The Overfat Pandemic, or something like The Overfat Adults and Children in the U.S. And we showed that 91% of American adults were overfat. And we were able to show that the latest data showed that exercise rates had increased, and the overfat pandemic kept going. The overweight and the obesity and the overfat numbers kept going up. So, and this correlated with what I saw in practice back in the early 80s when I started using the term overfat, because I didn't know what to call these people. They weren't overweight, clearly. They were called skinny people, but they had excess body fat, and it was really hard to measure accurately back then. I had there was a company I found who would come to your office and set up a water weight tank. It was really interesting. And every couple of months I'd have this guy come and set it. It took him a half a day to set it up, and we'd leave it for a couple of days, and we'd have people go in, and there were these skinny runners who go in, and they'd have excess body fat. And that was it was one of the more objective measurements we had, but still there wasn't a whole lot of data. And here the CDC's data, was there in black and white. So if you're listening to this podcast and your string test has failed you, don't think that, gee, I've got to run more miles, because that could actually backfire, because all you're doing is you're burning more calories by running more miles. But what kind of calories are you burning? Are you burning fat calories, or are you burning sugar calories? And if you're over fat to begin with, then it means that you're not burning enough fat calories. And if you're not burning enough fat calories, your running potential is huge if you can fix that. And you'll get rid of excess body fat, which will most likely get rid of excess weight, which will automatically get you running faster. But it's the increased fat burning that will get you running faster, because when you have more energy, you run faster, and fat is more energetic than glucose. You know, we're not talking about track and field here. We're talking about endurance. And so, and what people often do with a diet, as you mentioned, they say, well, I need to cut back on my calories. What that means is I need to cut back on the most calorically dense macronutrient, and that's fat. And if you cut back on your fat, you're asking for nutritional deficiencies. You're asking for problems. We need fat to burn fat. We need to eat fat to burn fat. Humans ate fat in the beginning. That's how we developed such great brains and such big bodies and such healthy conditions, and our longevity came from that. We were fat eaters. That's how it all started. We weren't even meat eaters. We were fat eaters. We were scavengers. We didn't, you know, there wasn't a lot of carcasses with meat hanging around. There were bigger animals than us that feasted on it, and if we went near it, we'd be feasted on. So we waited until they ate all the muscle meat, and we'd go up to the carcass and we'd realize that, hey, there's a couple of really interesting things here that was left. One is the brain. And humans had the ability to break open these brains, these skulls, and eat the brains. And the other is the muscle, especially the long bones, is the marrow inside the bone. You know, we'd smash the bones and marrow. And of course, brain and marrow are very, very high in fat. And so if we think I've got to lose weight, therefore I'm going to cut back on calories, which means I'm going to reduce fat intake, that's a huge mistake. So all those things you mentioned are the exact wrong direction. And that has been the thrust of diet books, diet programs, all the programs, all these businesses that are out there, like Weight Watchers. Why is it that 95% of the people who go on Weight Watchers either don't lose weight or gain the weight they lost back plus more? It's because that system doesn't work.
Phil, as you were talking about that, I was remembering a show that I've been kind of dipping my toe in every once in a while on the Disney Channel is Life Below Zero. And it follows these subsistence hunters up in Alaska, and they're, you know, foraging and hunting food. But one of the families, they, you know, eat this harvest and eat these moose and caribou and stuff like that. But the even the protein that they're eating is so low in fat that they, when they eat that, they dip the meat in seal blubber.
Yeah.
To give it a better taste, and because they know that they need fat in their diet. And I thought that was just really bizarre.
And blubber, blubber is a really, I mean, it's a commodity that Northerners have come to survive on, and they represent what it was like for early humans, the earliest humans, millions of years ago, who not only survived on a high fat diet, but thrived and allowed the human body to develop the way it did.
I always think that an endless interesting topic is, you know, our DNA hasn't changed as fast as our culture and society. And now we have convenience stores that we can go in and grab a packaged fuel and come out. We're feeding the same DNA that existed long ago when we were persistent hunters and gatherers and scavengers. And I always think there is a collision between, you know, the past and present, and the consequences are being over fat. So a really an interesting topic about how we're running around in these older design machines that were developed for efficiency in another environment, yet we're smack in the middle of this new world.
Yeah. And it's very sad. You know, when I was in practice, after a few years, I realized, you know, what was it? I'm feeling something I'm uncomfortable with something. What is it? And it was a sadness that so many people didn't want to change. Hmm. You know, you think, okay, this runner comes in and wants to get healthy, too many injuries, too many exhaustion, you know, mornings where you can't get out of bed, and bad race results, or someone who just, you know, has an impending disease or disease that is easily reversed. And when they find out what they need to do to correct the problem, they essentially say, oh, I don't want to do that. And of course, there's a long dialogue that can sometimes go on for visit after visit about, you know, I need to help this person decide that they want to be healthy. And it just took me so long to realize that I can't change their mind. If they can't decide to be healthy, I'm just spinning my wheels. And that's actually a common cause of burnout among professionals. And it's sad. And I could see that sadness today. I could see it in people who discover either on their own or through the help of others or family members or whatever, the answer to the problem that they have encountered. Let's take overfat. And they don't want to do anything. So what do you do? And I could tell you that this topic will come to a head in the public forum in the coming years. And the topic is, what do we do with these people? Do we devote resources to help these people when they become really, really sick? You know, do we do we devote a lot of resources to smokers who refuse to stop smoking two packs of cigarettes a day, and we pay for their lung transplants? There's some ethical issues here that are going to that are being discussed now. Some scary discussions, I might add. But you know, the bottom line here is that we're all individuals. We need to personalize our lives. And it's really up to us. It's not up to our doctors. It's not up to our insurance companies. It's not up to the government. It's up to us. We can control most of this on our own. We need information, and this podcast is a good example of a lot of the good information that's out there. And you have to sometimes sort out the junk, like all those bad diet books.
So
you know, if a diet book hasn't worked for you, don't keep buying diet books, because they're all essentially the same.
What do we do, Phil? We now know why that this is a pandemic. We've misunderstood it for all these years. What do we need to do if someone's string is getting stretched as they're measuring their ratio? What should they be thinking instead of going out and buying a diet book or running more and counting calories? What should they be doing?
Well, the metabolic effect is what's most important for most people, and our metabolism is set by the food we eat. So the food we eat is the lifestyle factor that needs to be changed. Even if we're smoking two packs of cigarettes a day, even if we consume too much alcohol, even if we're addicted to whatever, there are priorities. And from a metabolic standpoint, the priority is we need to change our metabolism from a fat-storing metabolism to a fat-burning metabolism. And it's as simple as that, and the specific remedy is even simpler, which is stop eating sugar. Of course, it's not only sugar, but it's things that turn to sugar, like all the white flour products, all the flour products. 99.9% of the floured products, you know, bagels, rolls, breads, and so forth, are processed flours that turn to sugar very quickly. And eliminating, we're not talking about cutting down, because there's a threshold. And if you try to play that game, you know, where's that threshold? How much could I actually get away with? Could I get away with one day where I cheat on junk food? Well, you can't. There's a recent study just published that showed people who are eating a very low carbohydrate diet, who have stabilized, takes a, you know, a few weeks, a month, or sometimes two or more, to stabilize your metabolism. And once this group of test subjects stabilized, they fed them one meal of junk food, and they were able to measure cardiometabolic impairment. They're able to measure pathology, inflammation in the artery, if I remember right. And after that one meal, just one meal. So we could talk about addiction and how if you cheat, you're going to maintain your addiction, and how if you cheat, you're going to, you know, you're never going to really kick that habit. Think of a heroin addict who does heroin only on Saturday night. You know, that just doesn't work. And this is, you know, this sugar thing is a serious problem. You know, we have a sick society where we equate love to sugar. You know, people say, well, I could give up sugar. Of course, not during the holidays. Well, when isn't there a holiday? When isn't there a birthday or an anniversary or, you know, some crazy thing where people break out the pink cake and say, hey, it's okay because it's a holiday, or it's my birthday, or it's your birthday, or it's my cousin Joe's birthday. He lives in Italy. I don't ever remember meeting him, but I know it's his birthday, so I'm going to have some cake. You know, we need to decide if we want to do this or not. And if we don't, have fun and eat all the cake you want. But if you want to be serious, it's really that simple.
Dr. Phil, I think it would be interesting to enter a time machine and be a time traveler. And this isn't off topic, and this isn't a rabbit hole that won't be fun to talk about. And go back to the point where there's the mark in time that industrialized food production happened, when a lot of flour and sugars became our mainstay. It'd be interesting to go back and evaluate with our eyes today some of the tools that we have and some of the evaluation tools, because we get to bring those in our time machine, to go back and survey the population, to see what they look like, to see what their string looks like as it goes around their waist. It would be interesting to do blood labs and different tests to see how we have disrupted our own health with our mechanisms of food production today. I think that would be interesting.
I do that time thing all the time. You know, when you're in the here and now, when you're in that zone of living in the moment, you don't have time. So you don't, you know, wherever you go, is not time. Let's not go there.
I think I see where you're headed, though. You could still live. Yeah. You can still live back in that time by the choices you make today.
Yeah, and you're right. Anthropologists do this. There are nutritional anthropologists who specialize in this topic. And we can look back, and of course we all most of us have heard about the paleo thing, you know, the Paleolithic period of time, which was not that long ago, and you know, and what humans ate. But that's a recent thing. When I say humans were fat eaters, I'm going back, you know, 2.4 million years when we defined the first humans. That's what they were eating. And as we got bigger and stronger, we ate more. We ate more protein. We ate more meat because A, we needed it, and B, we were physically able to fight off some of those animals that might have taken it away from us when we were smaller. But we didn't call it junk food until the early 1980s. But the processing of flour began, you know, 5,000 years ago or whatever, 10,000 years ago, you know, is when we started changing the agricultural revolution. That agriculture shift was when we started eating a lot more carbohydrate. It was cheap. It was easy to grow. We didn't have to run down animals. We didn't have to form hunting parties. We can stay home and just grab things and hang out. So it's a good... It's a good time machine exercise, but I've spent a lot of time reading anthropology, and I have a real hard time with it because they use so many big words, but I love it because they come up with all kinds of ideas. They never come to conclusions because they take pride in being super objective and only report what they find and don't come to conclusions necessarily, but it's still a branch of science that's quite fascinating to me.
You bring up the term hunting parties, and so I've often thought about that. What are today's hunting parties? And I think when we meet at the trailhead as a group of four or six or three, and we go out on a 2-hour or more run, that it is reminiscent to a hunting party. Maybe that's why we enjoy it so much and we thrive to be a community and get out there and go spend some time together on a trail that looked very similar to the hunting trails back then. I think our DNA is singing with joy when we do an activity like that, because it pulls back to the time.
And yeah, I mean, what a great point. I'm pretty quiet. I'm asocial, I'm antisocial, and I'm parasocial. But I remember throughout my life periods of working out with groups of people, running, cycling, open water swims, which was great because nobody ever talked. and there was something, there was always something special about that. And I kind of miss it, actually. You're right. There's that tribal feeling that we have when we're out on a trail with a group of people. Of course, I feel it when I'm by myself, and I'm sure most people do. It's very special, and it's being in nature. And for me, when I hear the word trail and trail running, I think of running in the woods or running through the fields or running through nature, places where other people are not, places where you don't see anything except nature. And that's a, you know, that's a wonderful thing. And today most people live in the cities or in the surrounding areas in the suburbs. And I know there's a trend to bring trails back, and it's being done, but they're paving it. And my idea of a trail is really to walk out my back door and go into the woods and just continue walking until I find an animal trail. That's my idea of a trail. And then running on that or riding on that with my mountain bike. Maybe I'm spoiled, but, you know, I grew up in the country and I've lived in the mountains most of my life. And that's how I kind of relate to all this.
And it doesn't take long to get onto the right trail. And they're in every location, they're out there. But how quickly it changes from modern day to it could be any time in that continuum that you're talking about. It could be 1,000+ years ago that it looked exactly like that, that our forefathers were on that exact look. It didn't look any different. There weren't planes going overhead and telephone poles and wires and people. It's just what it always has been. And that's what's so awesome about stepping onto the trail and back in time. That is a true time machine, Dr. Phil. We have discovered the time machine.
We do. And I, you know, one of my fondest memories is climbing one of the 14,000 foot peaks in Colorado. And you don't run at some point. You walk a few steps. It's a very steep climb, those last 1,000 meters or 500 meters even. And by the time you get up top, you're in another time. You're out there. And the biggest problem is you can't stay there too long because you've got to come back down. And it's a lot harder to get back down than it was to get up. And if you're not careful, you could run out of daylight. And so those moments for me were, you know, we're the most special, you know, and it's, you're on a trail for a little while, then you're off the trail, and then you're not only off the trail, but I don't know what you'd call it. It's a nothing. There's hardly ever anyone probably not many people have been there. And it's conceivable that you are walking in places that no one has ever walked. Heavy, man.
Well, that was a dramatic pause there. We were intentionally placing that in there. And I think that's what draws us all out
you
there.
Can play one of my songs.
Oh, I do.
You one of my songs during that pause.
Hey, you're on my playlist. I have some of your music on my playlist. I think that's what attracts us, not only as a group, and we gain strength as runners when we run together, and we open up conversations that wouldn't exist otherwise and through that time that we spend together, but also important to go out solo, to mix some of that, mm-hmm. because some of your self-discovery comes when there isn't noise from others, and you're the only noise is in your own head. Those are important times too. So
very much so. And I thanks for bringing that up. I can't emphasize the need to spend time not listening to this podcast or music or whatever people listen to. Spend time listening to your body. Spend time hearing your heartbeat and hearing nothing. You know, go out of your way to find places that you can do that, where you won't encounter anyone or you won't encounter any noise. And there's something very therapeutic about that. It's, you know, you get into that alpha state. You can, I mean, I've done a lot, even with groups, and I sometimes will take a turn and end up running by myself. And sometimes I get lost. I mean, I had a road bike for years, and I had to get rid of it because I was getting lost in the area where I lived and worked. I would just go out and go for a ride, and I would just get lost in my own mind, and I'd end up somewhere, and I'd stop and I'd look around, and I had no idea where I was. It's a wonderful experience.
Yeah, I usually find that I do a lot of my solo running just because I can't keep up.
you know, there is that what you're referring to, we've all experienced as we're thinking, have I run by that bridge? Yeah. Have I gone by that rock? Have I done that climb? And you really have no clue whether it's 2 miles behind you or 2 miles in front of you, because you've just escaped reality for a moment and you went somewhere else. It's very surreal and very, you know, it happens.
We had that happen the other day. Yeah, when Don and I were running.
Mm-hmm.
And those are highly therapeutic moments, and running has tremendous therapeutic value. But if you add this component, and the benefits your brain gets from being out there, it more than doubles the therapy you're getting that day.
Yeah. So let's talk about how important that must be. Well, I'll have to speculate. You can probably speak with some authority on this, but how important it is for that brain to be able to check out and the how necessary that is for mental health. And people do it either with some exercise like that, or they'll find a substitute. You know, they'll find a drug or alcohol or abusing someone else or something. They'll find something either positive or negative to totally escape their current reality and place them somewhere else so they can reset, perhaps.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's like, if it can be helpful, it can be hurtful. Sometimes we can check out too much, we can become a psychopath. And sometimes there's a fine line where we check out, you know, being asocial and antisocial and parasocial. If we're parasocial, it means we're talking to ourselves, or we have an imaginary friend that we're chatting with, you know, and runners experience this all the time. They're running along and especially if there's no one around, and they're having a conversation. Is that a mental health problem? I think it's the sign of a healthy brain. But if we say to our psychologist or to a psychiatrist, you know, well, yeah, I go out and run and I feel really good, and I have this conversation with this other person, you know, a red flag can go up. But I do that all the time. I do it for various reasons. I've started my practice for recording my new songs. And when I do that, I set up, my house is basically a studio anyway, but I set up a whole, you know, a bunch of microphones, PA, all of the stuff that I hook myself up as if I'm going to perform or as if I'm going to be recording in the studio. And I introduce the song to somebody. I don't know who that person is, but it's like I'm, you know, there's an audience. There may be an audience of one, but I go through this whole thing and sing the song to this person. And then I get feedback about the song. It's a wonderful thing. And what we have is that experience in children all the time. That's a state where we go into a theta state. It's a deeper, deeper state than the alpha state that we've talked about more than once on this podcast, and the value of being in that alpha state. But when we're in a theta state, adults typically don't go into theta. They don't want to be like children. The closest many of them come is as they're falling off to sleep. And just before they go into a subconscious state, they have these weird dreams. They're still alive, they're still awake, but their brain is alive with these cartoonish type images and thoughts and ideas. And that's the theta state. And children are in theta all the time. You know, think of a kid, you know, out in the backyard playing with sticks in his own little world. That's a theta state, and it's really, really healthy for adults to get in there when they can.
And that child is speaking to their imaginary friend, no doubt. I mean, that is one of the characteristics that you see when they have structured a complete friendship with this imaginary stick player with them. It's fun to watch.
Yes.
I usually find that I'm always right when I'm talking to myself.
Exactly. And
hey, Dr.
I remember years ago, a really good musician said to me, I had played him a song and he said, "That's really nice." And he knew I wasn't playing out. He said, "You know, writing a great song is half writing the song. The other half is performing it in front of people." And I thought, oh, damn, now I gotta perform, because I didn't think songwriters did that. And he said, yeah, when you perform, you're like in your own mind and these other people are there with you. And when you play the song, they're critiquing you. They don't have to say anything. You don't even have to look at them. You just know how they feel by playing your music. And I've discovered that with other topics, but certainly with music, it has been a real, real helpful thing for me.
You know, on the topic of music, before we close out here, because we seem to have an eclectic conversation, Dr. Phil, when we talk, we go everywhere with it. Just the brain, the magnificent ability of the brain to take, because you're playing this and you watch musicians play all the time with improvisational playing and jazz, and they're not reading the sheet music. It's so incredible to me that if you could see in the brain, there would be that sheet music, but it's in a different form. Just how the brain can remember, recall, replay, invent, and stay consistent note for note from the time you first played that song to the second and the fourth time that you perform it for others. You still hit all those same notes at the right time with the right intensity, with the right intent when that note comes out. It just makes me think how amazing the brain is and how sophisticated it must be.
It is, and it's an autopilot.
Yeah.
You know, we do it when we run. We do it, you know, during a workout. We don't think about, okay, now I got to bring my right foot forward, and but I know to need to contract these flexor muscles. You know, we're on autopilot when we run, and if we're racing properly, we're doing the same thing. We're on autopilot. And we can do that because our brain knows how to be on autopilot. We don't have to know how to race. We already know how to race. And it's a wonderful experience to be on autopilot. You can't always do it, but it's you know, what we had just talked about is going, you know, being here now, being in the moment, living in the moment, letting your brain go places, being in that alpha state, being in that theta state, being in that childlike state, which when you come out of is refreshing. It's like, gee, I'm what a great session that was.
I'm glad you brought it back to running. That was skillful. So let me ask this question, because you are not anti, because you're certainly on this podcast, but anti plugging in music or podcast. Let me rephrase that instead of anti. You identify the value of focusing on yourself and getting rid of outside distractions. That's probably more accurate to your position. Do you think that, let me tell you your position, Phil. And so do you think...
What do I think about that?
I'll tell you. Do you think there's...
Don's going to tell you how you think about it.
Do you think there's any type of music or rhythm or a drum beat or just some type of soundscape that is consistent with what we need when we're running out there? Something that isn't the same... tune or I can't think of the word that would help us find that spot.
Yes, for sure. It's our own rhythm. We have our own rhythm. And we could use our heartbeat, but you've got to be careful about that, because it can take you off course, because your heartbeat is only one of the rhythms that we have. But our brain is a rhythmic brain. Humans had rhythm from the beginning. You know, humans sang from the beginning. And rhythm was a part of it, because we had that area of the brain that produced rhythm, which we would have developed from hearing our own heartbeat, hearing our own footsteps when we ran and when we walked. And we all have our own rhythm. And it's sort of like, find your own rhythm. And it's a problem with, and I don't want to dissuade people from running in groups, but it's a problem when you're with a group, because it's harder to find your own rhythm in a group. And I'm not just talking about pace. In a group of runners, what you typically have is runners that start emulating, that start mimicking other people's gates. Mm-hmm. And now they're not running, they're trying to run like someone else. I have an article, and I never finished it, but I keep going back to it and putting some scientific relationships in there. But I have this article called The Illusion in Injury. And I noticed it when I was in practice. I noticed it, you know, soon after, you know, and back then, I mean, I'm only, you know, 39 years old, but back then, you know, in the 70s, in the late 70s into the 80s, you didn't see a lot of marathons on TV, but that's when they started showing on cable. You know, the big thing was cable. Oh, they're going to show the Boston Marathon on cable. Wow. And what I was seeing were people who were watching the marathon. And when they televised these things, it was usually the lead pack, lead men, lead women. And you'd get this image of these phenomenal runners, you know, running a sub-5 pace or whatever. And that image stayed with you. And when you went out for a run later that day or the next morning, you tried to run like that person. You tried to reach out with your stride, raise your knee up above your chin, you know, come on. Most people obviously couldn't run that fast, even for a mile. But they tried, because that image was there, and that was that was the herd mentality, which is a very real thing in psychology. We tend to follow the herd, and we physically will sometimes do that in the course of a workout with a group of runners. And so your goal is to avoid doing that. It's to follow your own rhythm. Getting back to the issue, which was, we all have a rhythm, and we want to run with our individual rhythm. And certainly, if we can't keep up, or if people can't keep up with us, and as we get older, it's usually that we don't keep up. That's okay.
Yeah, there's you have to be able to recognize the point of herd mentality is how we learn to run. I mean, we watch, we mimic, we see people talk and walk and run, and so that's how we learn. But there comes a point that you have to say, okay, I have that skill. Now I need to rely on myself and think about that rhythm and not try to emulate, you know, all these marathon runners, because that's not me. I'm
exactly. You're right, and we learn from the time we're born, probably from even before that, but we learn by watching, and the people we watch are usually our mother, father, or both, and that's why kids often look like their parents when they with their posture and their gait, because that's how they learned. Mm. And as you grow up and become, if you become more independent and more individual, you realize that you have your own unique rhythm, you have your own unique gait, you have your own unique style of talking, of thinking, and everything, and that's very important too.
And so, not to, you know, I'm just adding to the conversation. Certainly not speaking with any knowledge.
Facts.
Yeah, or facts, yeah. But to seek that and appreciate it, find it and accept it and allow it to happen. And just because someone is, you know, 10 steps in front of you or behind you, finding your spot is really where you're going to be the most efficient, whether it's your respiration, your heart rate, your cadence, how many times you're striking your foot on the ground, or your pace per mile or kilometer, whatever you're measuring. Finding that happy zone and staying in that rhythm throughout the entire run, whether it's slowing on the ups or increasing on the downs, or just not staying exactly the same all the time, but allowing it to move up and down and flow like a biorhythmic rate, that sometimes it's not always consistent. Our bodies are probably not meant to just stay static all the time. There needs to be some ups and downs, and to recognize that, not to look at the watch and go, okay, I need to be this pace every moment. There should be some fluctuation, and the body probably needs that to help metabolically and through its use of energy and reproducing the energy and doing different things and cooling itself. All these different factors that are endlessly fascinating. The body probably needs some of the variety.
Yes.
That's a great metaphor there, Freeman.
It does. And that's the idea of letting it happen. You know, you want to let whatever topic you're talking about, training for a marathon and how am I going to organize things and studying for a test and doing this. Sure, we want to practice, we want to train, but we at some point we have to let it happen, which means we want the brain to take over and go on autopilot, because the brain knows what to do. It's amazing what the brain can do for a runner and for running and making one more efficient. But if we enlist our memories and if we enlist the conversations we had, you know, with our friends over drinks, and reading these crazy running magazines, if we let that trickle into the brain, we're interfering with what the brain is trying to do, and we need to be very careful about that.
Yeah, and identifying a coach, if you're looking for a coach out there, it would be important that your coach acknowledges your individual rhythms and allow you to do that and not keep you boxed into whatever their spreadsheet says.
Yeah, or it's like a cookbook, you know, it's like a diet book. You go to a coach and, you know, well, your coach gives you the same workout as he gave this other person. That doesn't work. You know, if you go to a doctor, you don't want to get the same recommendations that everybody else gets. And sure, some people say to me, oh, you're going to recommend I not eat sugar. Sometimes things are so bad that you have to go with what's the worst thing and the one thing that's going to change more things than any other one thing. And that would be sugar in that case. But we need to find our individuality. We need to personalize our approach, and we need to let our brain into the process, because if we don't, we're stuck in a social unhealthy, because we have a sick society, unhealthy game that we're forced to play, and it's no fun.
Well, I think one of the takeaways that from this conversation for me is we're out on the trail and we learn to work through this endurance piece because we've become efficient and effective at listening to our bodies, to listening to when we need to slow or speed or change gait or something that allows us to stay out there that long is because of biofeedback and our processing of that information. And we should use that lesson on the trail and take it off the trail and use it with our nutrition and our sleep and our relationships or habits or conversations with people. We learn these skills, we practice them on the trail, but they apply to off trail too. And I think I'm going to start listening to my own body off the trail like I try to listen to it on the trail.
Yeah, I mean, runners are not only runners. We're people, we're fathers, we're sons, we're writers, musicians, we're all these other things. And it's all one package. It's you. It's the uniqueness of you. And it's a wonderful thing. And sometimes we get caught up in all these social things, running with a group and emulating someone else's gait, like I mentioned, and all these other things, you know, going to a birthday party, whatever. And that living in the moment is a big part of that being yourself. How do we be ourselves? Well, for one thing, you live in the moment. And when you're living in the moment, there's nobody else there.
Dr. Phil, thank you so much. This is always a great conversation that we have with you. We appreciate your wisdom and your science and the research that you've put into a lot of these things.
Thank you. It's always a lot of fun. What's this podcast about again?
well, we haven't come up with the title yet.
Okay.
Well, if you've enjoyed this podcast, there'll be a bunch of links in the show notes. Make sure you go and pick up those two big books, the big yellow one, the big red one. There is on philmaffetone.com, there's a great app there called the MAF Method, which Dr. Maffetone developed. And I always thought that was the MAF Method because of Maffetone. That's not what MAF stands for. Do you know what MAF stands for?
Metabolic.
Very close. You started with them. It's a maximum aerobic function. And it's a great app that you can use, does the two-week test, and it will help customize a method that you can better become healthy and become a fat-burning machine so that you don't become over-fat.
And Dr. Maffetone, in the 80s, you started making observations and leading us a few decades before we were ready for it. Mm-hmm. You started working with heart rate and as heart rate monitors came out and they wore vests and ran around the track, and you started leading the way with some of those thoughts and among many other things, nutrition. What are some things, as we wrap up, what are some things that people haven't heard yet that you've been you've been thinking about? Do you have a topic that,
is that a question to wrap up with?
Yeah, that's a wrap up. That's a this is called ways for next time.
We're committing him for a next podcast.
Yes. Are there still some things left that we haven't as a group been ready for, and you've been preparing our way for the last few decades?
The answer is yes.
Oh, good. Well, we look forward to it, and I'm sure there's probably some hints on your website.
There's always hints, just like the hidden meanings in songs. They're all there.
And we'll close out this podcast with a Phil Maffetone song, I assume.
Of course.
Don, Donald, edit that in.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll drop it in there, and just make sure that you're in a quiet moment to listen to it. You don't have to be on the trail running to hear it.
Yep.
Dr. Phil, thank you so much. Always
guys.
A pleasure.
Appreciate it.
Let's go out and run. Mas.
We're not sisters, not even brothers. Seems everyone persists to hate the other. Must be the human, ain't all that wise. 'Cause none of us are satisfied. We are not sisters, ain't even brothers, but all insist we're not the other. Must be the human is just the same as any living thing under the rain. We're all close cousins. Caress the cat, ignore the monkey that's on our back. It's just the human who wants to change it. Ah, the game.